Welcome to today's presentation of the Michiana Adventist Forum. Glad you could make it, even though it's such a nice day out there today. Good. Let's all stand, and Don Gillespie will open this meeting with a prayer.
Father in heaven, we're thankful today for the opportunity to talk about things that are important in our history and looking forward. We pray that you will be with us today and want to thank you for your blessing. In Christ's name, amen.
Our speaker today is Dr. Brian Strayer, and today's presentation is a continuation of our last forum meeting presentation 2.5 months ago. His title then was A History of Adventist Lifestyles, Part 1, and of course today is Part 2. And his subtitle was Some Facts, Some Insights, and Some Surprises. In Part 1, he talked about worship styles, the arts, Sabbath keeping taboos, sports, gambling, novels, theater, and TV. If you missed it and want to see it, go to MichianaAdventistForum.org, and you can find the presentation. You can listen to it and see it. Just some reminders, if you are not on our mailing list and want to receive our announcements about future forum meetings, we have sign-up sheets on both corners at the back. Give us your name and phone number and email address, and then you'll get our announcements. I also left some envelopes up there in case you want to give us a donation. We appreciate your donations. We do have expenses, and you can take an envelope home and stick a check in it and send it to us. I want to thank Dr. Stephanie Carpenter, Chair of the History and Political Science Department at Andrews, for co-sponsoring today's presentation. And let me tell you why that's important. Brand new rules. Any outside organization that uses a venue on campus has to be insured, and we're not insured. But by the History Department co-sponsoring us, we're good. So thank you, Dr. Stephanie Carpenter and the History and Political Science Department. Also want to thank the people that keep Forum going. Kathy Cadell, our Vice President, for always making sure we have a venue here on campus. She also makes sure that the computers work. That's huge. Takes a huge stress off my mind. Thank you, Jim Hayward, for doing our advertising. That's why you know about it. Jim Harris, that's huge. He runs our audiovisual system and also maintains our website. And thank you, John Ney, for writing the summaries of the presentations. In case you don't want to listen to the whole thing, you can read his summaries. And thank you, Bruce Zimmerman, for being our treasurer. Please send him your checks. Our speaker has agreed to a Q&A session after this presentation. Now let me introduce our speaker, Dr. Brian Strayer. Dr. Strayer grew up in Waterloo and Union Springs, New York. He has 3 degrees in history, bachelor degree from Southern Adventist University in 73, a master's degree from Andrews, and a PhD from the University of Iowa in 87. He has written 11 books, 120 scholarly and professional articles, and 40 reviews and critiques in French and Adventist history. After 41 years of teaching students from 7th grade to the doctoral level, and 33 of those years at Andrews, he retired in 2016. For 7 years, he's been a local celebrity. He writes a weekly column in the journal ERA entitled, The Past is Always Present. And guess what? It's about history. He's a frequent speaker at camp meetings, weeks of prayer and conferences and churches. He's currently writing a biography of Hiram Edson. That would be another forum presentation, wouldn't it? How's the book coming? Wonderful, wonderful. He's also doing a centennial history of the high school he went to, Union Springs Academy. Two events piqued his interest in the history of Adventist lifestyles. In 1981, while working on his dissertation in Paris, he attended the Boulevard Hôpital SDA church and saw French pathfinders, they called them Tissons, saluting their flag with the same stiff-arm salute that the Nazis had used to salute the swastika in Paris 40 years earlier. Then in 1990, while teaching history at New Bold College, he saw Norwegian SDA men playing soccer on the recreation field on Sabbath afternoons, something that never happened at Andrews. Did they keep score?
They did.
These incidents caused him to wonder why Adventists who believed the same 28 fundamental beliefs lived such different lifestyles around the world. So today in part two, he will focus on, I will let you tell him what he's going to focus on. Now, something happened in the few, in the 10 weeks since Dr. Strayer last presented. He acquired a, what he called a nice paperweight. And here's the paperweight. I asked him to bring it. This is a presentation to Dr. Strayer from the leadership of the North American Division in recognition for academic excellence and Christ-centered scholarship. And this was given to you at Southwestern Adventist at Southern Adventist University at the Conference of Adventist Historians. Okay. Congratulations, Dr. Strayer. Apparently, they gave out two of these awards. The other one went to Dr. Francis, Joan Francis. And Dr. Strayer was telling me that both he and she graduated with their master's degrees in history from Andrews.
Yeah.
So kudos to the Andrews History Department and to Dr. Strayer. So I think I've used enough time. The rest of the time is yours.
Thank you. Thank you. They told me that that award was a lifetime achievement award. I told them I'm not done yet. I live as long as my mother, who just passed away 2 months ago. I'll be 94 before I'm done. So I'm looking forward to some more research in the near future. In part two of the presentation, we will touch some very sensitive issues: dancing, sexual mores, dress, jewelry, music, temperance, diet, sanitariums versus hospitals, health foods, and fads. Let's see if we can get this to work. There we go. As Ellen White and her Methodist forebears had opposed the theater, they also banned dancing. When asked to contribute funds for the dances at Dr. Jackson's Sanitarium, our home on the hillside in Dansville, New York, where James was a patient, Ellen refused, saying, "I am a follower of Jesus." She called dancing a school of depravity that opened the door to sensual indulgence. Yet in 1891, en route to Australia, she and other Adventists on the boat attended a festival at Honolulu, featuring barefoot women in bright silk gowns, festooned with leis, dancing the hula. Although church publications in the 1980s and 90s condemned dancing for its unchristian associations and immoral temptations, many young people have disagreed. A survey taken in 1992 revealed that while dancing was prohibited by 78% of Adventist congregations and 61% of Adventist schools, only 46% of Adventist families enforced the no dancing rule for their children. Furthermore, 57% of Adventist youth disagreed with the church's prohibition on dancing. But a 2012 survey conducted by the former European Division Secretary, Reinder Brunsma, revealed that Ellen White's warning about sensual indulgence might have some validity, since, according to Bruinsma, 18% of Adventist couples cohabited prior to marriage. They did so, he said, for many reasons: financial hardships, fear of marriage commitment, and a desire to ensure the compatibility of their mates. Bruinsma urged church officials and laity to manifest sensitivity, love, and acceptance for those who chose a lifestyle widely condoned in some cultures. Others, however, worried that lack of commitment and some cultures' subordination of women could engender abuse within such relationships. One survey of 40 Adventist married women from diverse races, nationalities, and cultures here at Andrews University in 2012 revealed that 65% of them had experienced controlling or demeaning behavior from their partners. 46% had experienced common couple violence. 29% had experienced sexual victimization, and 10% had experienced severe physical abuse. Dress, too, had moral as well as health implications. In the 1850s, when fashion dictated that women wear expensive, uncomfortable, 15-pound dresses with hoops, corsets, bustles, trailing skirts, and high heels, Elizabeth Miller, Elizabeth Stanton, and Amelia Bloomer, along with Harriet Austin, popularized what was known as the American costume, with pantaloons and a short skirt. But while Ellen White called hoop skirts ridiculous, disgusting, and unhelpful, she opposed this American costume for its short skirt and the fact that spiritualists had adopted it. Instead, she created the Adventist Reform dress in 1865, made from black cloth, loose fitting, with a waistcoat and tapered pants covered by a skirt whose hem reached to the top of a woman's boots. This garment modeled the principles of modesty, plainness, function, and comfort. The Battle Creek congregation adopted it and mandated that members' attire must be scrupulously plain. Feathers, flowers, gold, silver, false hair, ribbons, and fancy buttons were verboten. Yet when many Adventist women refused to wear the Reform dress in the 1870s, Ellen White dropped it, urging women to find their own modest dress styles. Nonetheless, General Conference President George I. Butler insisted that the girls working at the Review Press wear the Reform dress. And former General Conference President John Byington bemoaned its abandonment in 1875. In his private diary, which we have here at Andrews, Byington wrote, "Oh Lord, save us from fashion." On the other hand, former GC President James White was privately happy to see the Reform dress abandoned because it embarrassed him when people stared at his wife Ellen wearing it in public. However, as late as the 1890s, when Georgie Harper wanted to wear a green velvet dress for her wedding to William A. Spicer, the church leaders in Great Britain forced her to don the Reform dress that all female church workers in England were then required to wear. But during the same decade in America, Mrs. White found some women's desire to return to the Reform dress objectionable and extreme. She refused to make the dress a test of membership. Obviously, setting dress standards lends itself to a bounded set mentality. We discussed that in part one. And this mindset has prevailed at Adventist schools for over a century, especially at boarding academies, Bulletins dictate male and female attire with great precision regarding what is appropriate to wear to church, class, PE, recreation, and in the dorms. For the girls, this often results in what I have called the battle of the kneecap regarding dress length, as well as plunging necklines, dyed hair, and heavy makeup. For boys, it usually means disapproval for tight, torn, tie-dyed tank tops and jeans. Ironically, one can fairly accurately determine what fashions are in style in the United States by examining these annual lists of banned clothing. Occasionally, such restrictions on dress have been taken to extremes. In 1939, Adventist pastor Siegfried Horn was rejected by a congregation in the Netherlands for wearing brown shoes instead of the mandatory black shoes to church. The conference president had to assign Dr. Horn to another congregation. As late as the 1970s, here at Andrews University, President Richard Hamel sent letters to female students reminding them of the dress code and urging them not to expose themselves in miniskirts. In the 1990s, President Richard Lesher sent emails to the faculty telling them to send students inappropriately dressed back to the dorms to change their attire. There was one professor in the history department who refused to do that. Like the Anabaptists, Puritans, Quakers, and Methodists before them, American Adventists saw jewelry, including wedding rings, as an inappropriate accessory to one's attire. At Millerite camp meetings, attendees dropped rings, breastpins, and earrings into offering baskets, declaring that the outside appearance is an index to the heart. Mrs. White opposed all forms of adornment, including bows, laces, and ribbons. Church leaders Daniel Bordeaux, J.N. Loughborough, and Uriah Smith found gold ornaments, brooches, and cufflinks unbiblical. Yet photographic evidence reveals that Adventist women wore jewelry at Battle Creek College, at Battle Creek Sanitarium, and even in the Battle Creek Tabernacle, where an 1893 revival resulted in 188 baptisms and the great jewelry offering, which netted $6,000 worth of gold watches, gold chains, gold rings, gold bracelets, gold cufflinks, diamond studs, and pins. But the Battle Creek College bulletins made no mention of jewelry at all until 1889, when it was considered, quote, not in good taste, but ostensibly was not forbidden. Ellen White herself sometimes wore metallic chains, pins, and brooches. Returning to the United States from Australia in 1901, she wore a conch shell necklace given her by the South Pacific Islanders. Her son William and his second wife, Ethel Lacey, wore wedding rings in Australia in the 1890s, and their daughter, Ella Robinson, later wore a necklace. As president of the California Conference in the 1870s, John Loughborough had sought to curb the wearing of gold necklaces, earrings, bracelets, and rings by Adventist women, as well as gold cufflinks and tie pins by the men. Yet a decade later, when the Loughboroughs were missionaries in England, John's third wife, Annie, wore brooches and pins on her dresses, despite Mrs. White's reprimands. Photos show Letta Sterling, the editor of the paper Our Little Friend, wearing a heavy gold necklace in 1886. Other church workers sported pendant necklaces and beaded chains as late as 1919. But the rise of the fundamentalist movement in the 1920s impacted Adventism in many ways, one of which was the banning of jewelry at Adventist schools. Over the next century, students at boarding academies were forbidden to wear necklaces, earrings, bracelets, rings, chokers, keychains, brooches, pins, ankle and friendship bracelets, body piercings, and tattoos. Although General Conference officials had condoned wedding rings in 1986, the church manual for 1990, citing 1 Timothy 2:9, urged members to dress plainly, abstaining from display of jewelry and ornaments of every kind. Likewise, Fanny Houck's 1987 book, Beyond Baptism, explained to new converts that Adventist men traditionally gave wristwatches to their fiancés and not engagement rings because, she said, watches worn for timekeeping purposes are not classed as jewelry. Conservatives valued such concrete standards as entry-level symbols separating converts from worldly society and thus demonstrating commitment to a set of values such as modesty, simplicity, and stewardship. Liberals, on the other hand, felt that wearing jewelry reflected local customs, not morals. Wearing it was a sociological act and not a sin. In a 1992 survey, 64% of Adventist youth felt that it was okay to wear a wedding band, and 42% disagreed with the church's ban on jewelry. Despite the medieval church's ban on the tritone as demonic, John Wycliffe, Martin Luther, and John Calvin encouraged congregational singing of hymns and psalms. Likewise, the Moravians and the Methodists sang exuberant gospel songs. Like the shouting Methodists, Millerite Adventists sang with fervent enthusiasm about the raptures of heaven because James White's father was a singing teacher and Ellen's family were shouting Methodists. They promoted congregational singing and hymn writing contests. James White included Baptist and Methodist hymns and white spirituals in his 8 hymnals, the first of which appeared in 1849 as Hymns for God's Peculiar People. James and Ellen's son, Edson, compiled 6 songbooks. And their nephew, Frank Belden, produced 7 hymnals. The most popular Adventist collections of songs have been Hymns and Tunes, 1869, the Seventh-day Adventist Hymn and Tune Book, 1886, Christ in Song, 1908, the Church Hymnal, 1941, and of course the current Adventist Hymnal, 1985. But 19th century Adventist congregations seldom sang in harmony. In 1859, Joseph Clark of Ohio described the typical Adventist singing group as deplorable. Quote, one prolonged a quarter note until it consumed the time of a whole note with a hold and a swell besides. Some were singing one verse until others had progressed pretty well into the next verse. In 1864, James White sent J.N. Lepro a box of lutes to help his congregation sing harmoniously. In the 1870s, Lepro, despite the fierce opposition of some members, introduced Adventists to children's choirs, singing lessons, and organs. You see, at the time, the organ was considered a secular instrument, suitable for the home parlor, but not for the church. Ellen White, who never attended a public concert or a private recital, disapproved of operatic and theatrical displays by soloists because they were not pleasing to the angels, who preferred simple songs of praise. She also felt that Roman Catholic music, with its outward splendor, pomp, and ceremony, was an evidence of inward corruption. But while visiting Europe between 1885 and 87, she did enjoy some classical, vocal, and instrumental music. In Sabbath school and church, however, she favored rollicking, soul-searching, emotional revival songs, accompanied by the organ or the guitar. She disliked duets, oratorios, frivolous ditties, and high church music. At home, she often sang for family worship. She sang when suffering arthritic pain. Sometimes in public meetings, she sang to awaken sleeping listeners. She sang when she was facing temptation. She sang while she bathed. She sang occasionally, even in her sleep. She strongly approved of setting religious words to popular tunes to help members sing more harmoniously. For example, Uriah Smith used Stephen Foster's song, Old Folks at Home, as the tune for his hymn, Land of Light, in 1858. And Frank Belden adopted many popular tunes to gospel songs for Billy Sunday's meetings. Several outstanding 19th century Adventist musicians deserve to be mentioned. Annie Smith, the sister of Uriah, wrote 300 poems. Many of them were put to music and are found in earlier Adventist hymnals. Roswell F. Cottrell, who came from a Seventh-day Adventist background, also wrote several hymns in the 1850s and 60s. Kate Amidon was an accomplished pianist, organist, and vocalist who performed for Adventists and Episcopalians alike. She played the organs at the Dime Tabernacle and also at St. Thomas Episcopal Church in Battle Creek. I might mention she was the daughter of Martha Byington and the granddaughter of John Byington, our first General Conference president, who himself came out of a Methodist Episcopal background. Henry De Fluter, the first paid Adventist musician, composed over 200 songs and led huge choirs and orchestras for evangelistic meetings. Frank Belden produced 7 hymnals and wrote scores of gospel songs himself. A musical genius, he could compose a hymn including all the words and the music while listening to a sermon and then sing it for the congregation at the close of the service while his wife accompanied him on the piano. Her name was Harriet McDearman. In the 1890s, Louis Schieff, one of our most outstanding black evangelists, chose a Pentecostal hymn book for his evangelistic meetings in the Washington, D.C. area. Finally, worshipers at the Holy Flesh camp meeting south of us in Indiana in 1899 sang Salvation Army-style music with tambourines, bass drums, horns, fiddles, and trumpets, much to the disapproval of Ellen White and Stephen and Hetty Haskell. Adventist music thrived in the 20th century once pipe and electric organs appeared in churches. Colleges and academies sponsored bands, orchestras, and choirs led by trained, usually male, conductors, and Adventist book centers sold recordings of Christian and classical music. But because the devices also played jazz and rock music, beginning in the 1920s, academies commenced to ban radios, and then later added phonographs, tape recorders, CD and DVD players, and Walkmans to the list. In the 1960s, however, contemporary praise music with electric guitars, drums, and keyboards replaced organs and pianos at some Adventist churches. Gospel rock songs projected on huge screens and led by praise teams replaced choirs and hymn books. And many feared that musical illiteracy would result. To combat such illiteracy, the Adventist Musicians Guild and the General Conference sponsored the compilation of a greatly improved Adventist hymnal in 1985, featuring 695 hymns representing an eclectic selection of gospel songs, Negro spirituals, youth songs, Advent hymns, folk hymns, Bach chorales, Scandinavian folk songs, Christmas carols, praise hymns, and communion hymns, all but eight of which had direct scriptural allusions. Yet, even in sacred music, Adventist tastes varied widely from classical, liturgical, and spirituals performed by the Aeolians to the New England Youth Ensemble, led, as you know, by Virginia Jean Rittenhouse, to the Ambassador Chorale Art Society, and Herbert Blomstedt, and Shi Yung Sung, to the country and pop songs featured by the Heritage Singers, and the gospel and folk tunes sung by the guitar-playing Wedgwood Trio. Despite attempts by an Adventist music committee in 2006 to establish an Adventist philosophy of music, strong disagreements exist between older members who would ban Christian pop, jazz, rock, electric guitars, and drums, and surveys among the youth showing that 83% of Adventist young people regularly listen to rock music, and 55% disagree with any bans on rock. During an antebellum era saturated with water cures, hydropathic sanitariums, and temperance books, journals, and lecturers, Adventists joined the American Temperance Society and later the Women's Christian Temperance Union, or WCTU. Church founder Joseph Bates had formed the Fairhaven Temperance Society in 1827 and captained temperance ships. Although he did not preach the health reform message prior to Mrs. White's 1863 vision, he led by example. Between 1821 and 1843, he had dispensed with grog, wine, beer, cider, tobacco, tea, coffee, meat, butter, grease, pies, cheese, and rich cakes, and lived on fruits, vegetables, bread, and water for the rest of his life. Aside from one brief bout with malaria, he was the only church founder free of illness throughout his 80 years. It is noteworthy that Adventists composed at least 10 temperance songs that were popular in the 19th century against the use of alcohol, tobacco, tea, and coffee. These included, just a few examples, the Temperance Rally, Look Not Upon the Wine, Sleeping on Guard, True Temperance Boys and Girls Are We. Some of the gray-headed crowd here might remember that one. Taste It Not, Touch Not the Wine Cup, The Song of the Rye, and The Tearjerker, Has Father Been Here at the Saloon? And of course, the ever popular Smoking, Chewing, and Spitting Song. There's the first couple of stanzas. Advent Review and Sabbath Herald articles against tobacco shifted from seeing it as an idol, a waste of God's money, and an immoral habit in the 1850s to emphasizing its body and mind destroying nature in the 1860s. However, in the 1860s, fasten your seat belts, folks, there were still a few Adventist ministers puffing on pipes and cigars in Wisconsin and Michigan. Yep. Ellen White, who urged members to vote for temperance candidates, called tobacco a filthy weed that must be given up by those who wanted to go to heaven. J.N. Andrews went further. He called it a sin. And J.N. Loughborough agreed with him. Loughborough barred smokers from church membership. Mrs. White and church leaders also condemned alcohol and drugs as poisonous substances that brought death to their users. Yet throughout the 19th century, one could easily obtain opium, cocaine, calomel, strychnine, arsenic, mercury, and quinine at the corner drugstore. In 1868, James White rebuked Adventists who raised tobacco and hops for beer, even if they did not use those substances themselves. "Get them off your hands as soon as possible," he exclaimed. Instead, Adventists were urged to join the WCTU and Dr. Kellogg's American Health and Temperance Association to enroll their children in temperance clubs and to sign the teetotal pledge, promising never to touch alcohol, tobacco, drugs or narcotics, tea or coffee in any form. And when I signed that pledge, I was 10 years old. Do you still have your teetotal pledge? In 1879, the AHTA secured 133 signatures to that pledge. A decade later, it had 20,000 members. Meanwhile, students at Battle Creek College who were caught using tobacco and alcohol were expelled. Led by Ellen White and the WCTU evangelist Sarah Marepta Irish Henry, her best friends called her SMI, after her initials, Adventists enthusiastically supported all temperance and prohibition candidates in the late 19th century. And Adventist evangelists regularly invited WCTU speakers to use their tents for temperance rallies. In 1882, Review and Herald printer and ordained preacher William Gage became Battle Creek's first Adventist mayor while campaigning on a prohibition platform. Well, in England, during the 1880s, the enthusiastic pledge-signing John Loughborough joined the Anti-Narcotic League, the United Kingdom Temperance Alliance, the Christian Temperance Missionary Society, the Band of Hope, the Vegetarian Society, and just for good measure, the Anti-Vaccination Society. Yes, J.N. Loughborough was an anti-vaxxer. You see, like many other 19th century Adventists, Loughborough felt that vaccinations depleted the body's vital force. But not all Adventists lived that healthy and balanced lifestyle with attention to the laws of health, as Mrs. White defined the word temperance. Some California Adventists were still using wine instead of grape juice at communion services in the late 1870s. In Switzerland, J.N. Andrews encountered wine-drinking church members and beer-guzzling, smoking attendees at his evangelistic meetings in the 1880s. In fact, in Switzerland, men refused to attend his meetings unless he followed the local custom by providing them with free beer and matches to light their pipes. And for a while, he relented, but seated the smokers and the drinkers at the rear of the hall. Review and Herald foreman George Amidon was occasionally forced to fire smoking and drinking press workers. In the 1890s, a dozen non-Adventist employees were jailed overnight in Battle Creek for public drunkenness. And yet, in their medicine cabinet, George and Martha Amidon kept a supply of Applejack. And for those of you who don't know what it is, you signed the teetotal pledge, didn't you? Applejack is brandy distilled from hard cider. They kept it in the medicine cabinet for treating bee stings. We can presume it was used externally. After 1895, those Adventists struggling with coffee and tea addictions could drink C.W. Post's non-caffeinated beverage called Postum. For the next century, this became a popular hot drink among both Adventists and Mormons in 71 countries. When it was discontinued in 2007, Postum sales had reached $14 million a year. 10 years later, the beverage was revived by Eliza's Quest Foods in Indiana, where its 5 full-time employees included 2 Mormons and 1 Adventist. Currently, sales have reached $1 million a year. So you need to drink more Postum to boost sales, okay? After the 1920s, Adventist boarding academies, which served no coffee or tea, expelled students for smoking, drinking alcohol, or using drugs. But as these practices increased in the 1980s, faculty required offenders to attend rehabilitation programs, such as the 5-day plan to quit smoking, later renamed the Breathe Free plan, and the 4DK plan to overcome alcohol or drug addiction. Elementary children and secondary youth annually received temperance magazines like The Winner and Listen, composed temperance jingles, speeches, and bulletin board displays, and signed the teetotal pledge. But a 1979 to 89 10-year survey of 1,500 Adventist teenagers indicated that 22 to 24% of them disagreed with the church's stand regarding alcohol, tobacco, and drugs. Another 1984 survey of 106 Glendale Adventist Academy teens showed that 25% of them had gotten high on drugs and 31% felt that marijuana should be legalized. 2 more surveys in the 1990s indicated that 20% of Academy students had indulged in binge drinking and approved of serving wine on social occasions. 67% of them regularly drank caffeinated drinks, including tea, coffee, and caffeinated soft drinks. In 1988, Professor James Nethery of Loma Linda University led the Coalition for a Healthy California to galvanize West Coast Adventists to secure the passage of the Tobacco Tax Initiative, the TTI, in 1988, which added 25 cents to every pack of cigarettes. Their petition drive gained over 1 million signatures. California citizens favored the initiative by a ratio of 3-1. And yet, paradoxically, in the 1990s, 3 Seventh-day Adventist members of the United States House of Representatives were taking money from 5 tobacco companies. Sheila Jackson, Democrat of Texas, who favored tobacco control legislation and had sponsored the No Tobacco for Kids Act, took $500 in tobacco money. Roscoe Bartlett Jr., Republican of Maryland, accepted $1,500 from RJR Nabisco. And Robert Stump, Republican of Arizona, took $14,000 from 5 tobacco companies. Next in importance to temperance is diet, and a host of 19th century health reformers sought to change American carnivorous habits to avoid dyspepsia, a common alimentary tract affliction, which could include a medley of flatulence, constipation, diarrhea, heartburn, and upset stomach. While church founder Joseph Bates had embraced health reform in the 1820s, James and Ellen White, like most other Adventists, were still eating meat in the 1860s. The Whites and J.N. Loughborough and his wife slaughtered and ate pigs, cows, chickens, and other farm animals regularly. Consequently, when asked to say the blessing at Adventist picnic gatherings, Joseph Bates prayed this prayer: Lord, bless all the clean, nutritious, wholesome, lawful food spread out before us. The rest just didn't get blessed. But in response to an 1863 vision at the home of Aaron Hilliard, Mrs. White, linking health with spirituality, urged Adventists to use natural remedies and eat a balanced vegetarian diet. She would elaborate on these recommendations in four of her books: Health or How to Live in 1865, Christian Health and Bible Hygiene in 1890, Healthful Living in 1897, and Ministry of Healing in 1905. While most Adventists adopted a balanced health regimen, some, like Dr. H.S. Lay, Elder J.N. Andrews, Elder Stephen Haskell, did go to extremes, opposing all use of salt, sugar, milk, and butter, and seeking to expel those who ate meat. For their peculiar dietary habits, Adventists in Battle Creek were nicknamed Gizzardites by the local citizens. The gizzard being the stomach, unquote. Yet many, even among church leaders and ministers, found it difficult to abandon their carnivorous diets. Between 1863 and 1894, Ellen White occasionally ate duck, baked fish, fried chicken, turkey, and tinned tongue, demonstrating that until she was nearly 70, she was more abstemious than abstinent in her diet. But in 1894, a Roman Catholic woman who attended her Brighton, Australia camp meeting vividly portrayed for Ellen White the suffering that slaughterhouses caused to animals. From that day forward, Ellen abandoned meat altogether for the rest of her life. After nearly starving on bread, cheese, and butter on his way to England aboard the ship Majestic, Stephen Haskell relented and finally ate some corned beef. But the Smith and Byington families regularly consumed large quantities of chicken, oysters, turkey, beef, roast broiled steak, roast mutton, roast beef, fish, and corned beef, both at home and while traveling. That is our General Conference president, folks, and the editor of our church newspaper. GC President O.A. Olson admitted that most Adventist ministers in the 1890s neither practiced, neither promoted, nor preached about healthful living. Shellfish and oysters were also consumed by 19th century Adventists, including the Whites, Smiths, Byingtons, and most believers in Europe. Not until the year 1903 did Stephen Haskell distinguish between clean and unclean meats based on the list provided in Leviticus 11. After returning from Australia and moving to California, W.C. White and his family enjoyed savory joints of meat in soups and meat hash. Battle Creek College served meat to its students from its founding in 1874 to 1900, when President Prescott became a vegetarian and subsequently banned meat from all the dining room tables, not just the two tables that had been set aside for vegetarians since 1891. Many delegates to the General Conference sessions in Battle Creek ordered chicken and steaks in the Battle Creek Sanitarium cafeteria. Until the year 1906, a meat wagon regularly visited some Adventist camp meetings. It contained codfish, halibut, smoked herring, dried beef, and bologna sausage, as well as coffee and tea for sale to camp meeting attendees. This so angered Kellogg that on occasion he would buy up the entire meat supply and ostentatiously bury it on the grounds. Ellen White's book, Ministry of Healing, in 1905, helped bring an end to serving meat at public camp meetings. In 1908, Mrs. White urged General Conference President Arthur G. Daniels, whom Dr. Ben MacArthur, his biographer, has called the church's most notorious carnivore, to back an anti-meat pledge. But he demurred, stating that this would create hardship for Adventists in Scandinavia, where fruits and vegetables were not readily available. I see Stan shaking his head, yes, yes. And in Brazil and Argentina, where beef and mutton were key products. One suspects, however, that the president, who regularly ate chicken, fish, and red meat, had personal reasons for not promoting an anti-meat pledge or wanting to make meat a test of church membership, as the German Reform Church movement did in the 1920s. Instead, Daniels agreed to sponsor more cooking schools to promote a vegetarian lifestyle. Although Stephen Haskell had drawn the line between clean and unclean meats in 1903, not until this information was published in the 1931 Adventist yearbook did it become official church policy. Not until 1951 were baptismal candidates asked to adopt vegetarian lifestyles. And only in 1981 was this incorporated in church doctrine as one of our fundamental beliefs. Consequently, despite the fact that vegetarianism is a unique belief among Adventists, not shared by other Protestant denominations, it is perhaps the least biblical of all church beliefs, and one of the most controversial. Yet scientific studies involving Adventists over the past 60 years have clearly demonstrated that those following vegan or lacto-ovo-vegetarian lifestyles do live longer lives, up to 7 to 10 years, less troubled by diabetes, hypertension, arthritis, heart disease, and a host of cancers. Nonetheless, a 1992 survey showed that 18% of Adventist young people regularly ate unclean meats, and another 16% occasionally did so. Despite 150 years of preaching vegetarianism, in the 1990s, only 28% of Adventists were vegetarians. By the year 2000, about 30% of General Conference delegates practiced vegetarianism. 70% did not. By 2019, only 19% of Adventists adhered to a vegan or vegetarian diet. Another 11% were pescatarians that ate fish occasionally. 32% ate meat once a week. 24% ate meat several times a week. And 14% ate meat every day. Perhaps somewhat more startling, only 6% of Hispanic Adventists claim to be vegetarians. Nonetheless, since the 1980s, Adventist book centers have done a brisk business selling 16 different vegan or vegetarian cookbooks. How many are gathering dust in your kitchen cupboards? Adventists also established institutions to promote healthful lifestyles. Their first sanitarium, the Western Health Reform Institute in Battle Creek, was modeled after Dr. James Caleb Jackson's Our Home on the Hillside in Dansville, New York. I led off with that picture, where a dozen sick Adventists had recovered their health thanks to a regimen that included hydrotherapy treatments, a vegetarian diet, fresh air, sunlight, rest, exercise, daily baths, and abstinence from tea, coffee, butter, meat, and white bread. Encouraged by Ellen White, John Loughborough raised funds for the WHRI. He recruited Drs. Lay, Trawl, and Byington to run it. He started the Health Reformer magazine, and he wrote a medical book, The Handbook of Health, in 1868 to promote healthful living among Adventists. When Dr. Kellogg took charge of the renovated Battle Creek Medical and Surgical Sanitarium in 1867, he made it the largest medical institution in the world, with 400 patients by 1902, including famous industrialists, writers, musicians, sportsmen, politicians, scientists, inventors, educators, and Hollywood actors. Despite some resistance after the 1940s, Adventist community and acute care hospitals began replacing sanitariums. By the end of the century, Adventists operated over 500 healthcare centers globally, with more than 7 million patients, in addition to scores of nursing homes, retirement centers, and clinics. They became world famous for innovations in infant heart surgeries, proton treatment for cancer, finding a cure for the Brazilian skin disease, Savage Fire, and taking medical care to remote jungle locations by riverboats and airplanes. Here we see the Halliwells, of course. Today, the Adventist Health System U.S., with more than 124,000 employees, operating 80 hospitals, nursing homes, retirement centers, home health agencies, medical offices, and over 300 walk-in clinics, is the seventh largest health system in America. And yet, mounting debts, which by 1985 reached nearly $1 billion and raised the specter of bankruptcy, forced the AHS to partner with other faith-based organizations in the 1990s, a collaborative business arrangement not without its challenges. Some of these challenges have included an Adventist health system based on representation versus a Catholic hierarchical system, the Adventist observance of Saturday versus Catholic's observance of Sunday, Adventist concern for doctrinal integrity versus Catholic concern for social justice and care for the poor, policy differences regarding abortion and contraception, Adventist opposition to unions versus Catholic support of unions, and Adventist historic hostility to Catholicism, which of course parallels Catholic's historic hostility to Protestantism. In addition to their health care system, Adventists operate health food factories around the world as a legacy of the Kellogg brothers' early dietary innovations, including the creation of granula, granose, bromose, nuttose, malted milk, nut butters, peanut butter, and artificial coffee drinks. In addition to La Loma Health Foods and Worthington Foods here in the United States, meat substitutes, cereals, and hot drinks are produced in Australia, Brazil, Argentina, and Germany. Adventists have operated some 24 vegan and vegetarian restaurants in urban areas. However, some extreme reforms have at times brought controversial results. In the 1860s, Dr. H.S. Lay at the WHRI advocated dispensing with salt, sugar, milk, and eggs, a position with which Mrs. White disagreed. Given her belief in the interaction between mind and body, phrenology also appealed to many Adventists. Pioneered by Franz Gall, a Viennese physician, phrenology spread to the United States in the 1820s and 30s as doctors and quacks analyzed the shape of the skull to determine the strengths and weaknesses of one's character. During the 1840s and 50s, traveling phrenologists gave readings at 25 cents each, and many physicians mapped out the bumps on their patient's head as part of their physical examination. James and Ellen White, their sons Edson and Willie, Uriah Smith and George Butler, among others, all had their heads read. Willie White, Jenny Tremblay, and the brothers John and Merritt Kellogg studied phrenology at Dr. Trawl's Hygiotherapeutic College in New York City. And the Adventist D.W. Rivas in Battle Creek sold the Phrenological Journal in the 1870s to pay his way through Battle Creek College. Phrenology also strengthened Adventist beliefs in vitalism. Vitalists taught that at birth, every human being is endowed with a certain amount of vital force. Poor diet, masturbation, sexual intercourse, and the use of drugs made withdrawals from one's vital force bank account and thereby shortened one's life. Loughborough, Kellogg, and Ellen White used phrenological and vitalist terminology in many of their books and articles. Yet, since many saw a connection among phrenology, vitalism, and hypnotism, Ellen White later rejected all three as satanic. In 1862, she rebuked Adventist ministers who practiced phrenology. But 3 years later, she was rather pleased with Dr. Jackson's readings of her husband's and son's heads at our home on the hillside. However, she was not very pleased with Dr. Jackson's prognosis that she was suffering from hysteria. Nonetheless, a debate over the benefits and dangers of hypnotism arose in the church in the 1990s. Dr. Jack Provancha believed that hypnosis rendered a person vulnerable to manipulation, presented ethical threats to one's integrity, reduced one's humanness, bordered on brainwashing, lowered personal inhibitions, and might therefore constitute a sin. On the other hand, Dr. John Baritz felt that Adventists should use hypnotism because it had been approved by the American Medical Association since 1958 as a therapeutic technique. It was effective in cases of anxiety, phobias, eating disorders, managing chronic pain, controlling bleeding, burn therapy, dermatology, and some dental procedures. It was also, he said, an alternative to drug therapies. It decreased mortality rates after surgery, and it did not make the patient become unconscious or lose control of their will. Finally, Dr. Selma Chai Mastrapa believed that since hypnosis was similar to prayer and meditation, it could help one relax, focus better on one's thoughts, values, memories, and beliefs, and enhance spiritual insights, faith, and trust in God. Another controversial topic among Adventists has been faith healings. Given the medical quackery that existed in the 1840s and 50s, Mrs. White urged members not to go to physicians, but to seek healing from God. Between 1844 and 1900, many Adventists experienced instant healing following prayer and anointing services. John Byington conducted a faith healing service in 1858, in which a woman who could not stand was healed instantly. She rose from her bed and dressed herself. Faith healings multiplied in the 1890s at Battle Creek. But Dr. John Harvey Kellogg remained skeptical, denouncing faith healings as fanatical zeal and a foolish exercise of faith. Ellen White herself warned against presumption. And as the number of Adventist sanitariums increased, she urged believers to seek healing there. Even today, some in the Adventist Church assert that faith healing, like miracles in general, presents certain moral dilemmas. Some argue that such miracles prompt unrealistic expectations. They create an addiction to the exotic and spectacular. They frustrate the quest for greater knowledge. They distract from the ways God graces us moment by moment. They tempt us toward hero worship and prompt doubts about God's fairness. And they frustrate God's attempt to let sin unfurl its true results, and can overwhelm personal freedom. A serious moral dilemma arose for Adventists with the rise of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis in Germany. Church papers emphasized similarities between Hitler and Adventists. such as the fact that the Führer was a vegetarian, a non-smoker, and a teetotaler, which is rather odd for a German. Thus, he is closer to our own view of health reform than anybody else in Nazi leadership. German church officials praise the Nazis for advocating a healthy, natural diet for a fitter nation, for their opposition to alcohol, drugs, and smoking, for their emphasis on race, hygiene, and eugenics, and for their cooperation with Adventist welfare and healthcare systems. Sales of cereal and bread at the Adventist food factory doubled during the Nazi regime. But many Adventist periodicals went further, defending the Nazi state as God-given, biblically sound, and according to natural law, supporting sterilization of deviants, portraying the Jesuits and the Jews as the cause of Germany's ruin after World War I, and encouraging Adventist colporters to sell 10,000 copies of Neues Volk, the Nazi racial journal, every single month. Finally, the General Conference worked with the Nazi Ministry of Propaganda and the Foreign Office to sponsor Hulda Jost, leader of the German Adventist Nurses Association and the Adventist welfare work, in giving lectures across the United States. However, German Adventists would later express regret for praising the Nazi regime in their publications. In conclusion, I hope that my presentation has shown that between 1844 and the present, there never has been only one Adventist lifestyle. While church leaders, pastors, teachers, and writers have upheld an ideal lifestyle based upon the Bible and Ellen White's writings, over the past 175 years, members have adapted this ideal lifestyle to fit their conservative, moderate, or liberal inclinations. Thus, to summarize, in the areas of Sabbath keeping, worship styles, the arts, sports, gambling, reading material, theater, TV, dancing, dress, adornment, music, temperance, diet, health institutions, and even in their fads, Adventists have followed many different lifestyles. And the recent surveys by Drs. McBride and Bailey appear to indicate that this trend will continue well into the 21st century. Thank you.
For those of us with gray hair or no hair, we're old enough to have lived much of the history you've been lecturing about. It brought back many memories, especially from my academy days. Let me tell you one briefly that I thought was quite entertaining. One of my classmates, back in our day, the guys liked to grow long hair, but we were restricted, and the hair could not go below our earlobe. Well, we let it go, but whenever the enforcers came by, we'd go like this. And then we were safe, because then it wasn't below the earlobe. One of my classmates whose hair was deemed too long, the principal inspected it and sent him to get a haircut and asked him, after the haircut, you come back and I'll approve it. So he got his haircut, came back, and it was still too long. I think that happened twice. And on the third trip back to the barber, he had his scalp entirely shaved and went back to the principal and said, is this short enough? And was suspended for 2 weeks. Okay, if you have comments, questions, please raise your hands. We'll bring a microphone to you.
As probably most of you know, I spent 42 years as a dean. 13 of those years in an academy level. And I want to approach this question from two different standpoints. One of the reasons that my parents started studying the Bible and eventually became Seventh-day Adventists is because of a woman who had lost her faith because she'd gone through two really nasty divorces. And she read in her Bible that God hated divorce, and so she figured that God must hate her too. So she stopped going to church, stopped paying tithe, stopped praying, and she married my uncle. He shipped off to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese, and while there, she began reading the Bible again, and eventually she began studying the Bible with my mother. One of the really interesting things that you have stirred in my imagination, she was a trained opera singer. She was a lyric soprano who played the piano like a virtuosa, which was a very unusual thing in a mining town in northern Idaho. There were precious few women to begin with, but a woman with those talents who have to be beautiful and at the same time was just unheard of. But somehow in her Adventist roots, she had learned those skills. What she presented would have made that a little left of center. I think that's quite interesting. I've got to tell you a personal story that's a Dean story. That follows up the statement just made. During the 60s and 70s, hair was a sacred obstacle for young men. And if there was going to be a conflict between the school, faculty, deans, and students, male students, it was almost always related to hair. And at Blue Mountain Academy in 1972, we worked out a plan that the students had actually initiated the idea to begin with that seemed to be perfect. We would allow them a certain amount of flexibility, and they could actually wear their hair beyond the earlobe a little bit, as long as they didn't flaunt it. But if they got a haircut notice from a dean, then they had to have their haircut to the minimum of the standard, which is basically like mine is today, or at least like Brian's is. And so nobody wanted to do that with 200 boys in the 1972-73 school year. We probably gave out less than 10 haircut notices. There was widespread compliance and cooperation. I was asked to go as a sponsor to a trip to New York City. The students had earned this, a few students, by raising money for a certain project. And the trip had been canceled already twice because of weather or some other problem. And so it was scheduled for the Monday before test week, very close to graduation, less than a week before graduation. And at 6:30 in the morning, one of the sponsors woke up and he was deathly ill. And so the principal called me and said, would you be willing to go as a sponsor? Well, one of the things that we were going to, that group was going to do is go to a New York Yankees baseball game. And so I was quick to comply and glad to go. And while I'm gone, Wes Schultz was the principal. Many of you will remember him. He in a conversation with my associate, decided to send out, because graduation was coming and they wanted the guys to stand tall and look sharp, to send out haircut notices to everybody, which tossed everybody under the bus and made people just so angry. And so when I got back on campus, I was exhausted, as you can imagine. It took all night to get back, and I went to bed. And I was awakened out of a sound sleep by one of the RAs saying, there's a riot in the dorm. And so I went up to the lobby, and there were 50, 60 guys running through the lobby, breaking lights, breaking windows as they went, and yelling like banshees. So I followed them. I never did go down to the worship room where my associate had scheduled a sit-out because somebody had tossed a pop bottle down a hallway and broken it at the end of the hall. And so the disciplinary reaction was a sit-out, which is always a bad idea. So all night long, I talked to guys and tried to bring them back to their senses. And finally, about 3 o'clock in the morning, the guys began slowing down, and actually many of them began sweeping up glass. And by breakfast time, all the glass was removed from the carpets, from the floors. A few days later, a board meeting voted with unanimity that I would be fired. They asked for my resignation. They were looking for a scapegoat. And Wes Schultz, and there are probably some people in this room who have negative opinions about Wes Schultz. He was a person who elicited negative opinions, thrived under negative opinions. He let the people, as he said, I've given you your pound of flesh and you've expressed that the police should have been called. Don Murray didn't do that. He didn't call the police. He attempted to settle it by de-escalating and talking to the guys. And that was the better way, because the police would have come and they would have had weapons. And there would have been a volatility that could have gotten out of hand. And so just to make a long story short, Wes asked me never to tell the story. He's been dead for a few years now. And after talking with his daughter the other day, I've decided this is a story that needs to be told. This was seen by the constituency, many of the faculty, and many students as one of the worst things that ever happened at Blue Mountain Academy. In the mind of Wes and me, it was a victory for decency, common sense, and the Spirit of God.
Very good. Very good. There's a hand back there.
That demonstrates the danger of long hair.
I'm so happy that I discovered that my religious ancestors are so normal. On a more academic level, Yarnoff Yanovsky, a well-known mathematician who wrote a book, What Logic, Mathematics, and Science Cannot Tell Us, he makes the comment that the universe accepts no false facts or contradictions. However, human beings are basically contradictory. And I remember when we came into the church, my mother brought my sister and I in the church, and one of the big items of discussion was whether or not we were willing to give up meat so we could be translated, or whether it was better to continue to eat meat and be raised with the general resurrection of the dead. I think, though, that Yarnovsky's comment deserves a lot of attention, that human beings are basically contradictory. And it's through the dialogue that we have with our contradictions that we finally come up with a set of values.
you. The side of the house is quiet.
Well, thank you so much. Very, very good, as always, presentation. What do you mean by Adventist? In some of your examples, you use institutional references and some individual. What do you mean? I mean, if... No. What represents Adventist? An individual or an institution? What do you mean by the term Adventist when you say Adventist lifestyle?
Adventists, then one is referring to the church population in general. If one says, Adventist beliefs or Adventist doctrines, then one is referring in that case to like the 28 fundamental beliefs. It's a term that's quite flexible. I don't use it in any one sense, except to say, as I do at the beginning and at the end, there's no one Adventist lifestyle. No one. Everyone may think they're living the Adventist lifestyle, but we all have different definitions of what that lifestyle is. But there are Adventist institutions, schools, colleges, sanitariums, hospitals, so forth. And there are Adventist individuals, Adventist churches, Adventist conferences, and so forth. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Is it working? Oh, yeah. I think you mentioned that we basically got our lifestyle standards from the Holiness Movement. The Nazarene Church had very similar standards to our own. You mentioned the Methodist, but... the Holiness Movement particularly promoted the kind of prohibitions that you referred to. Among their prohibitions was chewing gum. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yes. In the 1920s and 1930s at Union Springs Academy, students were forbidden to chew gum, run in the hallway, pass notes, speak above a whisper, and, problems that I think today's teachers would just love to have. Chewing gum was one of the chief offenses in the 1920s. Yeah, yeah. As a former college professor, now retired 7 years, I would just love to see my students chewing gum, occasionally running in the halls, speaking above a whisper so I could hear them when they talked to me. But those were verboten. Yeah, chewing gum, 1920s, 1930s. It was in the school rule book that they were not to chew gum. Yeah. I think long since disappeared. Yeah.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate the all the history here is very illuminating. My question. Maybe I'll preface it, and I think you might have drawn on this just a little bit in your presentation. Value Genesis in 2000, 2010, they measured young people's perceptions of how much they themselves, well, first they measured their level of support for various popular culture standards. And then they also asked them about their perception of to what degree were those enforced in the home, the church, and the school. And the interesting thing about that data is that young people perceive that these lifestyle standards are enforced to a much higher degree in the school than they are in the home and the church. And in some, on some measures, there's quite a gap between the school and the home. I think dancing is one of those, and you may have mentioned that. So from a historical perspective, my question is, How is it that our educational institutions came to be the standard bearers when it came to Adventist lifestyle? And is that something that they themselves took on, or is it something that maybe for some other reason was put on educational institutions?
Very, very good, Steve. Very perceptive question. I think if you go back to the beginning of our educational institutions, particularly boarding academies, since you referenced them, my research, I just finished the centennial history of Union Springs Academy, and so I went way, way back to the discipline committee minutes. Don't worry, I won't mention any of your names. I would say that in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, even into the 50s, the school and the home were like that. The school knew. The teachers knew, the administrators knew, the deans knew that if a kid had problems at school, you know, as my mother said to me in first grade, you know, if the teacher disciplines you at school, you're going to get it again when she calls me on the phone and you get home that day, you know? I mean, the home supported the school in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, into the 50s. As I read the discipline minutes at Union Springs Academy, I began to notice in the 60s and 70s, that began to change. The school was still enforcing high standard. I mean, Union Springs Academy had that as its byline, not world changers made here. It was the school of standards. I know I'm being recorded, but this is a fact, all right? It's an uncomfortable fact, but it's a fact. Oscar Eugene Torkelson, as the principal of Union Springs Academy, kicked out more students than any other academy in the North American division. And the school was at its highest enrollment. 172 students. But they had to toe the line or they were out. So there was a support network there, church, home, and school. The discipline minutes begin to show, however, in the late 60s and into the 70s, that parents were beginning to object to some of the standards. They were beginning to object to some of the strict disciplinary measures. And finally, in the 1980s, the school decided, okay, we will let some parents serve on our discipline committee. We'll bring the parents who can make it, you know, I mean, New York's a big state, who can come, sit on the committee, and we'll assign one faculty member to represent the student. And if the local church pastor wants to come, he can come too. So they began to expand the representative process to bring in a representative from the home, a representative from the church, as well as a teacher advocate from the school, because they were getting objections. Now, you know, in the first 30, almost 40 years of the history of the academy, whatever the academy said went, you know? I mean, if they kicked a kid out, that kid went. You know, and somebody drove him to the train station or the bus station and put him on the bus, put him on the train, he was out of there. But I would say late 60s into the 70s is a turning point where you find that the homes are not always supporting the school. And so for the first time in their experience, teachers and principals and vice principals, you know, are facing opposition from a sphere that they'd always gotten support from before, and it really throws them. So they compromise. They begin compromising on dress standards. You know, the school wanted a uniform, and the parents said, no, it's too expensive. We're not going to buy the uniform. So they had to back off, you know, and when they wanted to kick a student out, well, the parents would say, well, I'm bringing my pastor in. And some even said, I may consult a lawyer. And so they had to compromise. Yeah. Yeah.
I I was for more than 20 years a boarding academy teacher.
For more than 20 years, I am on now. I was teacher, principal, boys dean at mainly at Little Creek Academy and other schools. Little Creek did not expel anybody during that time period. And the one thing I said that I think after those 20 some years is I'd like to see four things off the face of the earth: alcohol, drugs, tobacco, and chewing gum.
I would also like to say that I don't know if you were principal in the early 80s. Okay, I was teaching at Southern from 80 to 83, and I was always glad to see the Little Creek students in my history classes. They were good students. They were good students.
One of my students is the president at Southern Adventist University at this time.
Today?
Today.
Okay. And he's also an alumnus of Southern as well. Yeah, no, they were good students. So you really helped them academically as well. Yeah. Yes.
Here. As you know, there have been a number of value genesis. One that was slightly different from the American one, once actually, because there have been multiple ones, was done in Europe, and it followed kids and young people up to age 25, and rather than stopping at 18. And one of the patterns we, because I was leading that research, one of the things that we observed was that drinking, the figures were equivalent to the ones you mentioned. But drinking was what we considered experimental, in the sense that after teenage years, it will gradually fade and disappear among young adults. I don't know today, this was done in 2008, and it had regional differences because in Europe, drinking is more or less tolerated depending on the country. But I was wondering, there is no comparable thing here in the United States because the age was younger. But I was wondering if you have seen in your studies an approach that is that takes into account the fact that at some age, there may be experimentation, and that experimentation eventually may go away, which is actually an emerging pattern also among wider youth outside the Adventist Church. What was that? Have you seen a change in educational institutions in the Adventist Church in the way these problems are dealt with, like rigid exclusionary stance, more educational, redemptive one? If you have anything to say, to share about that.
Sure. I mean, my prime example would be Union Springs Academy. I haven't studied other academies in the depth and detail that I have at Union Springs, but yes, I have noticed a change, and it's a good change. I would say the change could be described as redemptive discipline, rather than, you know, kick them out. I mean, if they're experimenting with drugs and this is the first offense, okay, we'll allow you to stay, but you sign a contract that you're going to become part of a 12-step program, and we're going to monitor your progress, and, you know, whoever your advisor is or counselor has to report to us that you are making steady progress in solving this problem. Same thing with tobacco, smoking, drinking. I mean, you know, when most of us were in college, you're caught smoking a cigarette, bam, you're out. I can still remember down there at Southern in 1982 when the boys, men's dean called me up and said, you know, a couple of my guys missed your final exam. I said, yeah, I noticed that. What happened? He said, well, they spent the night in jail in Chattanooga. I said, oh, really? What were they doing there? He said, well, they were caught drinking, and they were drunk and driving, and they were put into... I said, and they're still here? Well, he said, now, Dr. Strayer, we're trying a new redemptive approach. I said, well, okay, fine, fine. So I allowed them to take the final exam. But I think that is the more redemptive trend today, to try to work with a student in going through a program that will change their individual lifestyle. Some of these kids are coming from very dysfunctional families. You kick them out, send them back to their family, and, you know, I mean, that's where the problem started in the first place. You know, mom's drinking or dad's drinking or smoking or what have you. So work with them, redemptively, try to get them over the habit. You know, like you said, it may be just a temporary experimental stage. And so I have noticed that, and a lot more prayer. A lot more prayer. I just got the feeling in the 1960s that the principal was kicking kids out without any prayer at all. You know, you transgressed, you're out. You know, like, yeah, no, you didn't touch the base, you're out. You know, it just gave me the feeling that legalism was the prevailing attitude. But I think redemptive discipline would be the big change that I see in the rules and the way they're enforced. At Union Springs Academy, anyway, yeah. And if that school, which was kicking out more kids than any other academy in the North America Division, has made changes like that, I would like to hope that other academies have done the same.
I will take one more question back here. This will be the last question.
Thank you for your presentation, sir. A question. In your research, as you've been looking at the Adventist lifestyle, I was wondering if at any point you looked at the Adventist lifestyle in the African context, so to speak. For example, in the terms of long hair, what would constitute long hair in the African context? And also the issue, I don't know if you spoke to it or not, the use of the hat, the wearing of the hat, whether to wear a hat or not to wear a hat, covering the head or not. Did you speak to anything of that nature? Have you looked into that?
I'm going to shift that burden to you. Obviously, this has been a two-hour presentation, part one and part two. If I were to encompass the whole world, we'd be here till Christmas. There's just not time enough to encompass the whole world. So I focus primarily on North America, North American division. But maybe this will inspire you and others in other parts of the world to do the same kind of research in Europe, in Africa, in South America, in Asia, and so forth. It needs to be done, yeah.
The wearing of the hat was quite a divisive issue in the African church. Whether we should wear hats, women should wear hats or not.
I see, okay.
So that's why I was just asking about that.
Yeah, no, I never found hat etiquette, as they call it, to be a problem. I had one male student here at Andrews that just loved to wear his baseball cap all the time. I think he may have worn it to bed. But when I began class with prayer, he always took his hat off, you know, which I thought showed reverence. I didn't mind him putting the hat back on. It wasn't a problem. Or at least compared with other problems I had to deal with, I thought that wasn't even a problem at all.
Thank you, Dr. Strayer.
You're
this
welcome.
Was a very informative and very entertaining presentation. Thank you. Forum follows the school year, so there won't be any more forum programs through the summer. Watch your email for announcements on the next program once school starts again. Enjoy the rest of your day.